Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Caracas, Venezuela for an overview of today's presidential election from Jennifer McCoy, the director of the Carter Center's Americas program, who previously monitored and observed elections in Venezuela, but under the new rules for this election is accompanying the election. With Hugo Chavez's hand-picked successor Nicolas Maduro comfortably ahead of Henrique Capriles in the polls, we will get a sense of how the election, described by many as free but unfair, is proceeding. Then we'll get a political analysis from the ground in Venezuela from Antonio Gonzalez, the president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, who hosts a weekly radio show here at KPFK, The Strategy Session. We'll discuss today's voting and its likely outcome and get a flavor of the politics in this highly polarized country that recently experienced the death of its popular leader after 14 years of his Bolivarian revolutionary rule. Then finally, we'll look into the latest developments in the North Korean crisis that many expect will be inflamed further on the 101st anniversary of the birth of the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, which falls on Monday, April the 15th, which is Sunday, April the 14th in the United States. Paul Carroll, the program director at the Plowshares Fund, which is dedicated to reducing the risk of nuclear conflict, joins us. We'll discuss Secretary of State John Kerry's call for dialogue with the North while warning Pyongyang it risks further isolation if threats continue. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Jennifer McCoy, the director of the Carter Center's Americas program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. She currently directs the Carter Center's Friends of the Inter-American Democratic Charter Group and previously directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004. She's directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru. She's also edited and contributed to several books on the topics of Venezuelan democracy, the unraveling of representative democracy in Venezuela, and her latest, International Mediation in Venezuela. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer McCoy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So where do things stand in terms of, it's been said in a lot of press stories I've been reading about the current elections underway in Venezuela, that the elections are free but unfair. What's your assessment?
Well, the October elections for president in 2012, we participated as an independent study mission and wrote an extensive report in which we identified and described the election process, which is very similar to this one today. They have a very comprehensive and advanced automated voting system. So it's electronic voting with touchscreen machines, and the entire system is automated. That's very advanced. And there are many tests and audits of that. Both the opposition and the government parties participate in those and have expressed their confidence in the voting system, that the vote is secret and that the vote is counted accurately. We will see tonight if they make the same conclusions after today, but so far people have expressed confidence in that system. The opposition expressed more complaints in October, and we've heard complaints this time about inequities in the campaign process, inequities in the level of financing, access to the media, et cetera. Partly that is because Venezuela is an exception in the hemisphere in Latin America that does not provide public finance for parties or campaigns. And so it's all private financing. And so that will depend on the capacity of each side to raise funds. They have made allegations that the government has in the past used state resources in ways that give it an unfair advantage. So we'll have to see after this election the conclusions about this process.
Well, the candidate running against the handpicked successor of Hugo Chavez, Capriles, he's complaining, saying that the race is not fair. The candidate of the government uses the presidential plane, all the military, all the ministries. Venezuela's oil company pays for the campaign, and all the state media is supporting Maduro. This is unconstitutional. As you know, Jennifer, the only private media that's left that hasn't been taken over by the government or co-opted by the government, Globovision, is going to be taken over by a friend of the government's soon. So is the opposition candidate correct in his assessment?
You know, we I have not been here as an election observer. We do not have an election observation mission that has been here for the entire campaign to measure and observe all of these conditions that Caprilich has been talking about. And we're not going to be able to make an assessment of the election process because of that. Venezuela invites international accompaniment instead of observation. They stopped inviting international observation in 2006. So therefore, I can't make a comprehensive assessment. The opposition has talked about all of those things that you mentioned. In terms of the media, there are more private stations, but the one that has been the most, has had the most opinion shows and has been the most vocal in terms of having critical voices on it has been sold. I don't know who the new owner is or what the new programming will look like because that transfer hasn't happened yet. We'll have to see what happens. But that is true that the most vocally critical television station is in the midst of changing ownership now.
Again, I'm speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who is the director of the Carter Center's Americas program and a political science professor at Georgia State University. She currently directs the Carter Center's Friends of the Inter-American Democratic Charter Group and previously directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela. She is now in Caracas, Venezuela. So let me get a sense then of you say that you're no longer monitoring the elections, and the last time that you were an official monitor was in 2006. What happened there prior to this? There was some discussion that you wouldn't be let in the first place, and then apparently that has changed a little bit. I believe former UM Ambassador Bill Richardson has met in the Miraflores Palace with Maduro. What exactly is your mandate then in Venezuela today on Election Day?
We are here to show international interest and attention to this process, international support to the Venezuelans as they go through this special moment in their history as they've switched from, as they are moving beyond the mandate of President Chavez for 14 years in power, and they're now electing their new leadership for the next period. So we wanted to demonstrate this international support for a peaceful process and for Venezuelans to be able to live together harmoniously and to work constructively to address their problems in the future. The role of international accompaniment as defined by the Venezuelan Electoral Council is to be here to witness the process, to learn about the process, to be able to share experience of the process with other interested international people, but it is not to evaluate or to judge the process. That's what they have decided to move beyond. Their explanation of that to us, that decision to change the mode, is for two reasons. One is that they feel like they have created the confidence with the political parties in the process, where all the political parties participate in the audits before the election, and have witnesses during the election, et cetera. And two, the second reason is because there is not equal reciprocity. For example, the United States does not invite international observers. Not all European countries invite international observers, and so they feel like that they do not need to invite international observation, particularly from those countries. So those are the reasons that they give for having changed their model.
So what is the mandate then of Ambassador Richardson, former UN Ambassador Bill Richardson, who is down there, I believe, representing the Organization of American States? He's been appointed as a special envoy?
Well, that's correct. The Secretary General of the OAS, as I understand it, asked him to be his special representative for these elections in this role of international accompaniment. The Secretary General was invited to send an accompaniment in this model that I described.
I see. So given that you're there to accompany, not to observe, is there any restraints on you then in terms of what if you see something that is egregious? How do you deal with that?
We would, communicate with one of the coordinators of the voting station who are here representing the Electoral Council communicate something that we might have seen. But the rules are that international accompaniments do not, delegations do not comment on the process or the results before the results are announced by the Election Council, which we expect will be later tonight. And then the international accompaniers can give their reflections, their recommendations for the future after that, starting tomorrow. I should mention as well that there is an organized mission of accompaniment, but it's a more organized mission of the UNASUR, which is the South American Union of Countries, which has about 40 people who are experts, election experts from the various countries in South America, who are deploying around the country in a more systematic fashion, which is closer to the model of election observation that we would do in other countries. But they have been here participating in the audits of the machines for the last couple of weeks and are witnessing the election around Election Day. But there's been no organized missions really focusing on the campaign conditions. So we probably will not have an international report on that, but there are national election observer organizations who are here, who number in the hundreds. Each one has about 500 people, and there are several of those organizations. So Venezuelans are serving as their own observers.
So Jennifer McCoy, just then in a general sense, what is the atmosphere in terms of this vote? Obviously, the country's gone through a major emotional trauma with their leader who is deeply beloved by the majority of the people, the mostly poor and working people in Venezuela, and often reviled by the rich and by the middle class. Apparently, it's one of the most polarized political countries in the world. And, of course, Capriles is the opposition leader who's running against Maduro, the successor of Hugo Chavez. He has lost fairly, by 10 points last time. And that I think the polls put him at about 10 points behind in this situation. So the factors that I understand that are at play in this election are that go against Maduro are inflation, the necessity of a black market, particularly with U.S. dollars, and a lot of basic foodstuffs and commodities, and the pervasive violence and the lack of security for citizens. But on the other side, what works in favor for Maduro is, one, the extraordinary emotional legacy of Hugo Chavez, given that he's his handpicked successor, and two, the Guardian did a piece recently showing how much the poor in that country have benefited from the tenure of Hugo Chavez. It's quite extraordinary how they've been risen out of poverty. So am I describing this atmosphere in a way that you could recognize?
Yes, exactly. I think that's exactly right. You have, I said, 14 years of government, of rule by an extremely charismatic and personalist president in the form of Hugo Chavez, who engendered a lot of strong devotion and emotion from his supporters, who felt like that they had been given visibility and a voice by him for the first time. And so there's a lot of emotion. There was a lot of emotion surrounding his death. The fact that he endorsed Maduro before he died is very important in this election, because people, his followers, will likely support Maduro because of that endorsement, and because they want to continue, those who believe they have benefited from and will benefit from this process that they're calling a revolutionary process, want that to continue. On the other side, there are a lot of problems in the country with services, public services, with crime, high crime rates, et cetera, shortages of food and electricity. And these are things that that whoever wins will have to address. These are things that are criticized by many people. So, but larger than that, there are different visions for the future of the country. So one is this more revolutionary process, and the other are the opposition, who say that they want to restore democratic rights that they feel have not been respected, restore more efficiency and more respect for the private sector, more efficiency to the government. They've been promoting these kinds of ideas. So the country has been polarized with these different visions and with really you know, extremely different levels of support or opposition to the government. And so the hope is that after this election, there will be the opportunity to begin to come together to at least agree on the basic rules, the minimum rules of rules of the game, and respect for the rights for all, and even while maintaining their differences on specific policies, specific strategies of development and public policy for the future. But we'll have to see how that plays out. Today, so far, what we see is really participation of both sides together in the same voting places. They are, you know, very civilized. The places that we have visited, obviously, we're only in a very few places around the country. We'll have to, you know, hear the reports from the whole country. But we see a lot of what they call convivencia aquí, which is the ability to live together, to work together, you know, among the common people.
So the polarization that resulted, from my understanding, in the Chavez era, the government released the electoral rolls on a compact disc, meaning that everybody in the country essentially could find out who their neighbors voted for, with names, addresses, and what their political affiliations and preferences were, and that this created a kind of tremendous pressure on neighbor to neighbor to vote for Chavez. So you're not describing that kind of polarization.
No, this was something that happened 8 years ago, and this was the publication of a list of people who signed petitions for a recall vote against the president. It was not, you know, the identification of the vote. The vote's always been secret. And so there was, you know, some recrimination against those people who had signed this petition to recall the president. But what we see is, yes, strong differences among many Venezuelans, let's say, on the vision or on the level of support for one party or the other. But there are a lot of Venezuelans who, in the middle, simply want to address the problems of their daily lives, want their leaders to come together to address that, and, you know, who do live and work together. So it is a politicized country. People do talk about politics a lot, but in within the political parties, there are very strong differences. People tend to be labeled easily as one side or the other, but in reality, there are many people, I think, who, you know, consider themselves what they call ni-ni, neither one side or the other, as well, in the middle, or who feel like they could live with both, and many who are on one side or the other, who do want the country to be able to work together to solve the problems.
Well, Jennifer McCoy, I thank you so much for joining us. I know you're very busy today, and I appreciate the time we were able to spend with you.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Jennifer McCoy, who's director of the Carter Center's Americas program. She's in Caracas, Venezuela. She's a political science professor at Georgia State University and currently directs the Carter Center's Friends of the Inter-American Democratic Charter Group and previously directed the Carter Center's Project on Mediation and Monitoring in Venezuela from 2002 to 2004. She directed election monitoring projects for the Carter Center in Nicaragua, Panama, Mexico, Venezuela, Jamaica, and Peru, and has also edited or contributed to several books on the topics of Venezuelan democracy, The Unraveling of Representative Democracy in Venezuela, and her latest, International Mediation in Venezuela. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting an on-the-ground political analysis from our own Antonio Gonzalez, who is in Caracas, Venezuela.
Mujer, hombres gentiles siempre hay mil, por eso para tu bien, borrala de tu cabeza, conquista de nuevo a esa mujer, no sé si es como para alegrarse.
From the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount, which I don't pretend to understand at all, it's coming from the silence on earth. Dock of the bay, from the brave, the bold, the battered heart of Chevrolet. Democracy has come to the USA.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Caracas, Venezuela, is Antonio Gonzalez, who is president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the United States, founded in 1974. Antonio Gonzalez is and the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project have been central figures in the dramatic growth of Latino political participation across the country. And during the first dozen years of Gonzalez's tenure at the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, they've helped double Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 10 million registrants in 2006. He currently appears as a regular commentator on Public Radio International's Tavis Miley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. In 2005, Time magazine named Antonio Gonzalez one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing. Antonio, we just apparently lost the call, so I'm waiting here for to be reconnected, and hopefully that will happen in a moment. Antonio, are you with us?
I'm here.
Well, it's great to talk to you, Antonio. We're talking then with Jennifer McCoy, who gave us a kind of nuts and bolts overview of the mechanics of the elections, that it's on these touchscreen machines, very advanced. Both sides agree that they work. There's none of the fear that we have here in the United States about electronic voting. By and large, it hasn't been angry and polarized. It's been quite calm and civil, which is, of course, is not what we've been hearing about politics there. And the candidates have been slinging some mud at each other. One, Maduro calling Capriles a rich kid, and Capriles referring to him as a kid as well. So give us a sense of on-the-ground politics. What's your read on what's happening today?
Well, first, I just want to reiterate in Jennifer's point. The Venezuelan electoral system is infinitely superior to the American system in terms of the quality and equality of machines, the training of electoral officials. It's really very, very impressive. I think Jennifer was probably being a little kind because it is a Or comparing tendentious elections to tendentious elections, because compared to America's elections, the Venezuelan elections are indeed very polarized. Lots of harsh rhetoric, a lot of scuffling. I was in a meeting with representatives of the Capriles campaign, which is the opposition campaign, the right opposition, and they were making accusations, including that armed men were preventing voting, or would prevent voting. This is before the election, in the outlying regions, probably more towards the Colombian border, and that there was a lot of intimidation of Capriles supporters in Chavista strongholds and that kind of thing. And I don't doubt there's a pretty strong tendentious campaign atmosphere. They're polarized. These are two very different projects. The, Capriles campaign, Enrique Capriles Kowalski, is a neoliberal sort of restoration campaign, and the Maduro campaign is a continuation of Chavismo, which is slowly but surely marching towards socialism. So they're very opposed. A lot of campaign tactics in and out. At one point, Capriles Kowalski was running a Me Too tactic, saying he would sustain a lot of the Chavista social programs. But that didn't last, and it became more polarized towards the end of the campaign. Election day is, by and large, however, at this point, based on the reports and talking to the other observer groups and accompanier groups, pretty normal. Participation was slightly down from The record turned out in October of 2012, where you had more than 80% of the eligible voting. That compares to about 50% of the eligible in the United States. So turnout is a little bit down, but not much. And the conventional wisdom here, Ian, is that high turnout benefits Nicolás Maduro, the candidate of the Socialist United Party of Venezuela. And lower turnout benefits the conservative opposition. And at this point, we're sort of in a place where it looks like turnout is not fantastic, but also not bad. There are some early exit polls that have Nicolás Maduro in the lead by about 10 points. But that was as of 10 o'clock this morning, and the latest... remember, these things are not public. These are all like who you know within which campaign and stuff. The latest is that lead is narrowing. And remember, it's a Sunday, and the big surge of turnout is expected in the afternoon. So there's a long night before us.
Again, I'm speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voting participation organization in the United States, where he has helped double Latino registration from 5.4 million in 1994 to more than 10 million registrants today. And he also hosts his own weekly radio show here at KPFK in Los Angeles, Strategy Session, and he's in Caracas, Venezuela, observing the election. And in terms of Capriles, he has tried to suggest that he's a sort of like Lula in Brazil, a social democrat. And on the other side, I don't know whether that's working in any respect, but on the other side, you've got Maduro continuing the legacy of Chavez. When you talk about polarization, I want to get a sense here in terms of comparing to our politics. When you have candidates like Maduro referring, saying that the Americans poisoned Chavez, referring to the other side as Nazis and lackeys of the American Empire, how is that similar to, in terms of tone and attitude, to the kind of totalitarian politics that parts of our Republican Party here in the United States? I mean, Karl Rove just doesn't want to beat the Democrats. He wants to grind them into the dust. And Ted Cruz and Michelle Bachmann refer to Democrats routinely as being un-American and essentially traitors. So is there an odd comparison between the Venezuelan left and the American right?
You get hot... you know, very hot language and insulting going on in Venezuela on both sides of the equation. Now, remember, Capriles was the candidate against Chavez in October of 2012. And then Chavez dies, and so he's sort of tiptoeing around the sainted memory of the father or, you know, godfather of the country, given that we're still in that mourning period. So he had softened his rhetoric for a while and had said, he tried to claim the, I'm a more of a social democratic candidate, and said that he would keep some of the Bolivarian social missions, which are essentially social empowerment programs. But that rhetoric really changed and heated up once he realized the last 3 months of the campaign, 3 weeks of the campaign, that Nicolás Maduro is not running a particularly good campaign. Maduro's not been a candidate. He stumbled around for a while, said some sort of wild things, implying that he was visited by the spirit of Chavez in the form of a little bird. That's a big joke here in Venezuela. And he's not a polished candidate. I was watching him on national news yesterday, or Friday, on late night news, and he was exhorting the voters to massively turn out tomorrow, until somebody flashed him a note that the election was on Sunday. Oh, and God. He had to, like, you know, sort of, you know, stumble over himself and had a little bit and say, no, I meant Sunday. And he's not a skilled candidate. And that's been apparent for some time. So the Capriles has bared his fangs over the last several weeks, and the polarization has deepened. You know, this is a mobilized country. There was marches of hundreds of thousands of people on Thursday and Wednesday to close both campaigns. You drive across Caracas, and when you're on the center and the west of town, the image of Chavez and Maduro is everywhere. Billboards, electric signs, banners hung on buildings, graffiti everywhere, T-shirts. It's mobilized and it's organized. That's true. But then you cross over this indivisible median line in the center of town and go to the east of town, which is more of the middle class and affluent. There is a Beverly, an equivalent of the Beverly Hills of Venezuela in a town called Chacao, which is the stronghold of the opposition. And the exact opposite is true for Capriles. T-shirts and everyone's talking about it and billboards and banners hung from skyscrapers and so on. So both sides are mobilized. The opposition realizes this is their best chance to win power. And history is against the left here in the sense that there's never been a high turnout election without Chavez on the ballot in the Chavista Bolivarian era. The elections alternate from very high turnout when he's running to, you know, pretty ho-hum turnout for a congressional or gubernatorial or constitutional reform elections. And, you know, people say socialism is against democracy. You hear that a lot in the United States. Well, Venezuela's combined votes. They have a national election every year on something. There's an election. But this is the first time you've had Chavez is not on the ballot. So we'll see. Preliminary indicators are that the turnout will be good enough for the Chavista candidate Maduro to win election, but, you know, the day's young.
Well, we had a surprise, for example, when the war in Nicaragua ended, and there was an expectation that there would be the Sandinistas would win the election, and they didn't. The first post-war election, if you will, and that was a surprise. So
you are absolutely correct. I was there observing those elections with a congressional delegation in 1990, and I remember arriving in the country. It's February of 1990. The polls say Daniel Ortega 58, Violeta Chamorro of the UNO, the opposition candidate, supported with U.S. money, Ortega's the Sandinista candidate, 58-40. And we go to the closing march of the Sandinistas, and I kid you not, there were 500,000 people there. And the next day, there's the elections. A few days later, there's the elections, and Ortega didn't get 500,000 votes. And in fact, he lost 58-40 instead of winning 58-40. But that's a very different context. There was war, death, a broken government that couldn't fund social programs. None of those are at play here in Venezuela. Nevertheless, one gets, you know, itchy thinking about those memories, and I remember them clearly. I don't think that'll happen here. I think it'll be close race, but the Chavistas continue to seem to have a mobilized and well-organized electorate. They certainly have the campaign and political infrastructure in place, even though at this time they don't have Hugo Chavez.
So when you described Maduro as being somewhat a clumsy candidate, that reminds me of an interview I did a while back when Capriles was first running. And he was described that way as being awkward. He tried sort of hugged people, but he was kind of a bumbling kind of candidate. So has Capriles gotten better?
I talked to a top campaign pollster here, who's been typically associated with the left, and he told me that Capriles has run the better campaign. He has become more powerless since his first run last October, and he has run a campaign based on issues talking about the very, you know, the very real problems here in terms of public security, in terms of scarcity of certain foodstuffs, in terms of inflation, all things which would vex the middle class more since the poor receives subsidies for subsidized food and stuff. But he's been run a clear campaign, whereas Maduro has, you know, he was in mourning, and then they were saying, we're going to continue Chavez, continue what's been going on. And depending on how you articulate that, does that mean continue the good or continue the bad?
Well, Jennifer McCoy was saying that she, by the way, in terms of monitoring this election, that there was possibility of the monitoring continuing, but now the government changed the rules to international accompaniment as opposed to monitoring, where they can accompany. They can't object to anything until after the election results come out, which are apparently later this evening. But the I asked what the reasons were for this, and she said, well, one of the reasons was that that there's no reciprocity of international observers in the United States, for example. So I guess, you know, we're not in a position to lecture the Venezuelans about, one, you said their election system is much better than ours, but two, we don't allow observers. And I guess if we had observers in Florida in the last election, we'd be looking pretty bad.
The world might be different. I think that's right. For example, I'm here invited by the National Election Council of Venezuela, but I'm not an observer. I'm essentially an unofficial witness. We have access to polling places. We've been educated on the polling process. For me, this is my fourth Venezuelan election. It's a knowledgeable group of people. You certainly, and you can certainly say what you see, but you have no official role. And let me just tell you, there are multiple national observers and party poll watchers from all the parties in every polling place. Venezuela is a politically organized country, left, center, and right. And given the excellent system that it's been talked about throughout the world how good the Venezuelan electoral system is, the physical system, the training of the workers and so forth, I am confident, given the sort of poll watching that you see from interested parties, that you have a, at least election day is fine. Now, the campaign, this atmosphere and so on, I wasn't here. I'm certain there was a lot of things going on. There's tension in the country. But election day seems fine.
So if it's close, just in closing, Antonio Gonzalez, if it's close, would that therefore mean that the politics in the going forward would be less strident and less polarized if there was a recognition that the Chavistas and the Bolivarian Revolution isn't getting the kind of support it did before under Chavez?
The figure that I've heard is around 10 points. If Maduro wins by around 10 points, which would be Chavez since 1998, won no less than 11 points up to 26-point presidential victory. So they say the magic number is around 10 for the opposition to accept its defeat. There's a gray area from 5 to 10, and once you get below 5 points, and no one here says that Capriles is going to win except for Capriles' campaigners, if you get a win of less than 5 points by Maduro, you can expect that the opposition will protest, would not accept its defeat, and there will be tensions and who knows what boiling over in the aftermath. It reminds me of the scenario in the 2007 election for socialism. Venezuela, Chavez put directly on the ballot, let's vote in socialism, change the constitution, here we go. And at the end of the day, Chavez lost. He wasn't on the ballot, but he campaigned very good for it. and he lost 50.1 to 49.9. The urban myth here is that he really won. And I've heard it again and again and again from people that I know are in the know, that he really won, but his victory was so narrow that the government conceded the election before finishing the vote count and finagled it with the National Electoral Council to avoid civil war.
Hmm. Well, we should follow up on more on that, because that's an interesting, and we've run out of time, but since we crossed paths here at KPFK, let's have another conversation, Antonio.
I'm happy to have it, Ian. Thanks for having me, and hello to all my fans and listeners, and you're doing a great job.
Thanks a lot, Antonio. Again, I've been speaking with Antonio Gonzalez, who's president of the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, the largest and oldest nonpartisan Latino voter participation organization in the United States, founded in 1974. He has been a central figure in the dramatic growth of Latino political participation across the nation, and during his first 1,000 years at the Southwest Voter Registration Education Project, Antonio Gonzalez has helped double Latino registration from 5.5 million in 1994 to more than 10 million registrants in 2006. He currently appears as a regular commentator on Public Radio International's Tavis Smiley Show and hosts his own weekly radio show, KPFK, in Los Angeles, Strategy Session. In 2005, Time Magazine named Antonio Gonzalez one of the 25 most influential Hispanics in America. And we talked to him from Caracas, Venezuela. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether something is going to happen today, Monday, in North Korea on the 101st anniversary of the birth of the founder, Kim Il-sung.
The Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia, and whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Carroll, the program director at the Plowshares Fund, which works on disarmament issues and eliminating nuclear weapons worldwide. He's responsible for managing the grant making at Plowshares and ensuring that resources are directed towards the smartest people with the best ideas for reducing the risks of nuclear weapons and reducing conflict. Previously, he worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, the United States Department of Energy, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Carroll.
Thank you, Ian. I'm happy to be here.
And Secretary of State John Kerry visited South Korea, then China, and then Japan, where in Japan he said that he called on North Korea to join a regional dialogue. At the same time, he warned North Korea at risk further isolation if its threats continued. So for the longest time, we have been matching North Korean threats with our own sort of pride and bluster that we're not going to be pushed around by this pipsqueak, which sending over B-2 bombers and having this military exercise. And a lot of people, including myself, have been quite concerned that the U.S. is sort of, you know, in its own sort of superpower bubble, has been blundering into a possible war, which would be catastrophic. So we're still sending mixed signals. On the one hand, we wanted dialogue, but at the same time, warning them not to keep threatening. Do you think the worst is over? Because there's a lot of concern that today in North Korea, which is tomorrow here in the United States, the 15th of April is the 101st anniversary of the birth of the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung, and there's an expectation that something may happen on this day.
Yeah, you hit a couple of critical points. I think that Secretary of State Kerry's visit is actually a very good development for a couple of reasons. It's obviously our top diplomat, and having a top diplomat in the region as opposed to a military chief or a Department of Defense, even civilian leader, sends a very different message. Even though his words were mixed with the line we've heard again and again, you face continued isolation and ostracization, the invitation to come back to a regional dialogue is significant. It's the first time, really, in weeks that we've seen any beam of daylight suggesting that we have dialogue and discussion with the North. I think the what's important to keep in mind with respect to the B-2 and B-52 flights and the F-22 flights, I agree with you. I think it was over the top or not. It was more than we needed to do to send a message to the North, but it was also as much, if not more, about reinforcing our alliance with the South, with their newly elected president, President Park, and basically reminding them, although perhaps with a bright yellow highlighter and underline, that, hey, you're still our ally, we've got your back. I think that message probably was sent a bit too strongly, because sending B-2s up the peninsula and dropping mock bombs, I think, did exacerbate the situation. What you said about the possibility, though, of a catastrophic war, I think that's really what's at risk, because in this kind of an environment, when you've actually got men and materiel moving around, and you've got this rhetoric at a pitch that we've not seen really for 30 or 40 years, the risk of an accident or a miscalculation or an errant gunshot or even short-range artillery shell shot, that's the kind of thing that we've seen in past history leads to war, not by intention but by accident.
And, of course, all of those measures that would reduce accident and miscalculation, such as the hotline, that's been withdrawn. The people that traveled every day into the north, into the Kaesong Industrial Park, they've been withdrawn. And I talked to a former CIA officer the other day, Bob Baer, who has been talking to people in the agency. They're quite concerned about a miscalculation, and one of the reasons that they're concerned is apparently that the United States depends, and its military depends enormously on signal intercepts, particularly in Afghanistan. The Taliban spend most of their time on cell phones and on radios. But in North Korea, it's completely dark. They don't use anything that we could monitor, and they're in tunnels. They use landlines, and if anything happened, it could happen right out of the blue. There would be no warning. So, what's the situation today on this huge holiday in North Korea, which is the combination of the 4th of July, Christmas, and New Year's all rolled into one, the birthday of, I think it's called the Day of the Sun, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think I read a story, and if it's to be believed, several days back that I thought was really striking. It was a description of how the United States and South Korea had actually gone a step further this time around. This annual military exercise, it's called Full Eagle this year, that they actually had sat down and drawn out very precise plans about what they would do jointly to respond to a North Korean provocation, and actually an actual attack of some kind, like the shelling of Yongpyeong Islands in 2010 and the sinking of the corvette Chenon in 2010. And on the one hand, I think that's a good thing, because if you can be very very clear with one another that, hey, we will respond, but we're going to be measured and we're going to be in concert, you minimize the risk of things spiraling out of control. On the other hand, it again feeds into this cycle. You know, the North Koreans read our press. They know as well as we do how our governments, how our militaries work. And it again amplifies this idea that, hey, you know, we're not going to take anything that you send our way sitting down. Not that we should, but again, rather than have that message sent out, why not have some type of a channel of communication, some type of an off-ramp for the North I was listening to your show and guests, and they talk about how, you know, perhaps Kim Jong-un has talked himself into a corner. Well, that's a very real possibility. It's really incumbent upon the South, the United States, and frankly China, to offer an off-ramp for the North where they can, with some kind of saving face, walk back from this situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Carroll, the program director at the Plowshares Fund, which works on disarmament issues and eliminating nuclear weapons worldwide. Now, China, though, I'm just wondering whether, of course, John Kerry, was Secretary of State, was in China on Saturday, and the new Chinese leader has sent signals that he may be irritated with the North Koreans. But my sense, Paul Carroll, is that the Chinese are actually pretty comfortable in a way with North Korea, because it sort of throws South Korea and Japan off balance. And, you know, even though they're not necessarily in a military competition, they're certainly in an economic competition, Japan, South Korea, and China, for global markets and in manufacturing. So I'm wondering if that's a part of it. And on our side, we have the ubiquitous military-industrial complex that needs an enemy. They lost the Soviet enemy. The terrorism, a few guys living in caves, the Bin Laden and company, don't really make it as enemies on the scale of the Soviet Union. And the best we've got now is this weird little aggressive but very weak tyranny, or tyranny of the weak, as one author has written about North Korea. I bring that up because clearly this leak coming from the Defense Intelligence Agency via the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee was so flagrantly designed to make North Korea look more dangerous than it is, that they've really got a weapon that they can stick on a ballistic missile. And it was just the one page of a minority report that was leaked to the public. I mean, that's pretty flagrant, but not surprising.
Well, yeah, you've raised a couple of issues. Let me start with China. You're absolutely right. This is where the complexity of Northeast Asia and the different geostrategic relationships come into play. I think it's fair to say that China, is certainly the strongest ally, is probably too strong a word, but the strongest sponsor of North Korea. They're not exactly best friends, though. They're sort of codependent in a way. It's pretty convenient for China to have a bit of a buffer between itself and South Korea and Japan. It's a sort of a flank, if you will, that North Korea's presence keeps them, you know, they don't have to worry about it so much. And it's critical to understand one thing, however, that the United States has for years now looked at North Korea almost exclusively through the nuclear lens. And that is to say, it's been about the proliferation or possibility of the proliferation of nuclear weapons. China looks at North Korea very differently. They have a higher threshold pain, if you will, from the North's nuclear shenanigans. What they really fear, their number one priority with North Korea, is stability, like with all things. They're like Wall Street bankers. They don't like uncertainty. They don't like the chance of things tumbling. And so if there's any kind of an implosion in North Korea, any kind of a regime change, a cathartic change, you're looking at a 23 million population, most of which, or much of which, will spill over the Chinese border, and they've got a refugee crisis on their hands. The Chinese don't want that. So what really has to happen in the medium and long run is for Beijing and Washington to begin to get on the same page and say, you know what, we have different number one priorities, but there is a lot of common ground here. Let's talk about what that common ground is and come to some, you know, arrangement about how to approach North Korea. You know, with respect to the DIA report, I can't really say with any confidence whether it was leaked or meant to stir things up, but it's old news. It's actually not much different than a DIA analysis from years back. And I think it's actually irresponsible to have that aired in a congressional hearing and make it seem as though North Korean nuclear missile capability is anything greater than what most of the rest of the intelligence community says. I agree with you on that point, that it's not helpful. I might even go so far as to say the people that benefit from that are Boeing and Lockheed Martin, who have missile defense contracts.
So just in closing then, Paul Carroll, at this point I haven't seen anything on the wires that indicate any missile launch or any provocative act. Is it possible that in trying to get out of this, something will happen, you know, like the torpedoing a ship, something that with less fingerprints will happen in the final analysis?
Well, I think it could be even better than that. Let's not forget that Kim Jong-un and his apparatus, they can tell the North Korean population anything they want. So that's, in this case, actually useful for us because they can write a script that says something like, we stood up to the outside imperialists, we faced them down. It may end with a whimper, which would be fantastic. It may end with perhaps a diplomatic meeting where our military exercises end and we leave the area and North Korea says, see that? Because of our strong stance, we you know, sent them packing. We have much less to lose than the North. And I think what needs to happen in the United States sort of domestic and political scene is to recognize that to discuss and go into dialogue with North Korea isn't weakness. It's not caving into tyranny. It's about keeping your eye on the ball for the long gain. And if you keep your eye on the ball for the long gain, you know, you have to hold your nose a bit in the near term, but the option, the alternative is far worse.
Yeah, the alternative being the death of millions of people and the destruction of much of South Korea. I would think that in the world of adults, you know, being responsible as opposed to being rhetorical is a much better course of action. And anyway, I don't need to preach here, but I thank you for joining us, Paul Carroll.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Carroll, who's a program director at the Plowshares Fund, which works on disarmament issues and eliminating nuclear weapons worldwide. He's responsible for managing the grant making at Plowshares and ensuring that resources are directed towards the smartest people with the best ideas for reducing the risks of nuclear weapons and reducing conflict. Previously, he worked at the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, the U.S. Department of Energy, and the United States Environmental Protection Agency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.